Hi, I'm James Naylor Green, Professor of Brazilian History and Culture at Brown University and the National Co-Coordinator for the U.S. Network for Democracy in Brazil. This program is part of the Democracy Observatory and is supported by the Washington Brazil Office. This is Brazil Unfiltered. Before I start the program today, I'd like to invite all of you to join us on a Brazil Unfiltered special program on the elections that will be held on Sunday, October 2nd, starting at 3:30 p.m. on Twitter Space. The program will be analyzing the election results as they come in on Sunday and inviting special guests to join us in analyzing what happened that day and what are the possibilities for the future. Hope you can join us on Sunday, October 2nd, 3:30 p.m. on Twitter Space. You can find our special Brazil Unfiltered Election Day coverage by going to the Twitter of the Washington Brazil office, Brazil_office. Hope to see you then. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming journalist Fernanda Mena. For the past 12 plus years, Fernanda has worked at one of Brazil's most important newspapers, the Folha de São Paulo, both as an editor and as a reporter. Before arriving at the Folha, she worked at Piauí, Fantástico, TV Globo, and UOL. Fernanda is a leading voice in the debate about the prohibition of drugs and the policies of policing. In 2020, she completed her doctorate in international relations at the University of São Paulo. Her dissertation analyzes different approaches to the legalization of cannabis in the United States and in Uruguay. Additionally, Fernanda has written extensively on numerous topics related to human rights, with the focus on the themes of security, inequality, and diversity. I also want to highlight her work as the host of a wonderful 10-part podcast series called Cada Pessoa, which I highly recommend for anyone who speaks Portuguese. The podcast was produced by Folha Newspaper in partnership with Conectas and explores many important human rights issues. Fernanda, welcome to Brazil Unfiltered. It's such a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, James, for the invitation. It's my pleasure to be here.
Great. So let's jump right into the situation. What has been the state of human rights in Brazil under the Bolsonaro government?
I would say is as worst as can be. President Bolsonaro is being notorious for attacking human rights far before his election for the presidency. And Brazil has been regarded as a very complicated country in human rights terms, mainly because of its huge inequalities. So you have here a marriage of, you know, a worst scenario with the worst person in charge possible, which, because it is one that opposes to human rights as a principle, let's say. So we, what we saw during those years is the dismantle of many instances, formal instances of fiscalization, of public transparency, of civil society's participation in governments, and at the same time of the praise for guns that has, you know, a certain, which has repercussions in terms of violence, because, you know, that's what guns produces. Death, basically, more than anything. So we have seen, you know, abuses from security public forces, and that's not novelty for Brazil, but it has, you know, certainly became more robust, at least in narrative terms. And of course, when we see the intersection about, you know, climate change, Amazon devastation, indigenous people's rights, you know, it all comes together in a big, complex problem that Brazil's got to face. And from now on, the more urgent of all is, it's not a novelty in Brazil, but it is a novelty in the last two decades, which is the hunger that the country is facing. This is the more urgent because this not only compromise people right now, and, you know, that just don't have food in their dishes, in their homes, but also future generations, because we have seen that one in each three Brazilian houses where there is a child with less than 10 years doesn't have enough food for them. And this has a big repercussion, not only in terms of cognitive development, but also in how those individuals are going to be able to contribute to society in the future.
So we're approaching the elections. Things are really heating up in Brazil. How are you seeing the electoral situation right at this moment? What is your kind of overview of the situation politically?
Well, what I see, it's Brazilian most polarized and violent election since the country's redemocratization in 1985. And then we think that our democracy continuously has less than four decades of age. So it's so recent and somehow fragile because of this instability in the last century, let's say. And, you know, Brazil has been shaken by a controversial impeachment process against President Dilma Rousseff in 2016, followed by Jair Bolsonaro's election. And, you know, all this scenario that I just mentioned about human rights, you know, his attacks to the attacks to democratic institutions, especially the judiciary. So I have talked to a colleague of mine to get a more informed view, let's say, about how does he see the election, which is Fabio Zanini, the political columnist at Folha. And he has an interesting view on the main discursive battles that is being played out in this election, which I think might contribute to our conversation here. So he sees that at one side, Bolsonaro, who has 33% of voters' intentions, according to the last data Folha for the first round, by one side, he is evoking the relative improvement of the economy as his main campaign platform. Although prices in Brazil have skyrocketed recently, and we see the consequences of it in the back of hunger that, you know, keeps 33 million Brazilians right now in a situation of extreme nutrition insecurity. I don't know what is the expression that you use in English.
You know, that works. We use that as a kind of a translation. People who are in absolute poverty or on the risks of being in poverty. I think we understand.
It's more than just poverty. In Brazil, we'd say insegurança alimentar grave, which means that, you know, they allegedly don't have food every day.
Right.
So, which is, you know, I don't need to call attention for the gravity of the situation such as this. And on the other side, you have Lula with 45% of voters' intentions on the first round, evoking a sort of civilizational agenda of humanitarianism, of human rights, of social and cultural rights, democratic values, transparency, etc. So he sees it as a sort of civilization against barbarism ballot battle in discursive terms. And therefore, if Lula wins this election, and we have no surprise in respect of the results, you know, if the results of these elections are respected as they must be, it will be the first and unprecedented victory of a values agenda to the detriment of an economic agenda, which has always been the man responsible for results in presidential elections in Brazil. So this is something new for us to keep an eye on, and as the results play out, see how this is going to influence politics in practice.
So it looks like at this point, as you point out, that the polls indicate even a possible victory in the first round, if not certainly in the second round, short of any unexpected surprises.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to that 20 to 30% of the population that still supports Bolsonaro, in your opinion?
Well, they're just going to be around, and they're probably going to make things more difficult to Lula besides all the challenges that he he's going to face once in office. And this is something that Brazil is going to just have to deal with. I've recently interviewed Paulo Sérgio Pinheiro for a story, and he mentioned something that at first shocked me, but then, you know, made a little sense. He said that, you know, Brazil is going to have to pass through a process of desbolsonarization, similar to the process of desnazification that happened in Europe after the Second World War. And, you know, I was quite shocked to hear that, you know, comparison. But, you know, we kind of got used to see comparisons among, you know, extreme right from the worst regimes in modern history with Bolsonaro. And actually, I think that nothing's going to happen that is not through education, honestly. And this, you know, we have, you know, a long way in terms of respect for basic fundamental rights and respect for each other and improving the public debate and making it an arena in which we can honestly exchange ideas and not bullets. So,
you know, in that regard, I can't help but think immediately of the ways in which Bolsonaro has consistently attacked the media, and especially women journalists. The most dramatic one is Vera Magalhães, the journalist who has been systematically denigrated by Bolsonaro and disrespected as a woman, as a journalist, as a serious, intelligent person. How do you, as a female journalist, deal with this issue of the violence and the discursive violence and even possibly physical violence against journalists, especially female journalists?
Well, it is awful. I feel so sorry for my colleagues that has been main target for hate speeches and fake news. And not only Vera, but Patricia Campos Melo from Folha has been systematically, she's been targeted for such articulated.
Well, I think in a way, as I read it, that it's really trying to silence these journalists, to attack them so much that they're demoralized. I think of the way Bolsonaro and the right attacked Jean Willis, a congressperson, and had death threats against him, where he felt he needed to leave the country to guarantee his life. And to do that against the press, the free press, is really serious. It's a undermining of democracy in a profound way. Fernanda, let me turn a little bit to other parts of the electoral scene. I know that's not your area of expertise, but I think
just prepare myself for it. reporter I am.
but I think you do know a lot about what's happening, and I think our listeners will be very curious to hear your analysis. One of the first things that's happening very interestingly here in the state of São Paulo is the fact that Fernanda Haddad is in the front in the election. For those who need a reminder, Haddad was a philosophy professor at the University of São Paulo and Lula's Minister of Education. He was also the mayor of the city of São Paulo. And in 2018, when Lula was in prison, he ran as his vice president. He then assumed the candidacy for the presidency and got 45% of the votes in the second round. Do you think there's a possibility that he might win the election? And if so, what will that mean for São Paulo? What will that mean for Brazil?
I guess Fernando Haddad never had a better chance of winning than now. The government of a state that has been governed by the PSDB for three decades in a political continuity that it's not necessarily good for the most populous state of Brazil. We have today, of course, better numbers in public security, in health, and in education. It's not a tragedy. And São Paulo has better numbers than mostly the rest of the country. But we collect many problems as well of the size and complexity of the main megalopolis of Latin America, São Paulo, where Haddad has been a mayor. So I believe that Haddad, in terms of the chance that he have, his victory depends mainly upon which of the opponents he will have on the second round. with him. On one side, one possibility is Tarcísio de Freitas from Republicanos, which is a former Bolsonaro's infrastructure ministry and his ally for sure. And on the other hand, you have again PSDB, which has been in the state of São Paulo for 30 years, in the person of the current governor, Rodrigo Garcia. So today, Haddad has 36% of voters, Tarcísio has 22, and Garcia has 19. If his opponent is Tarcísio, his chances increase. If it is Garcia, it is less likely he will win. And this happens, and Eduardo Scolesi, political editor of Folha, explained that to me. Because São Paulo traditionally has a very pronounced anti-PT bias. Rejection of Lula in São Paulo, according to the latest Datafolha, points to 39%. But the rejection to Bolsonaro managed to overcome the São Paulo's anti-petism. So Bolsonaro rejection is 53% today. This means that facing Tarcísio would be theoretically less challenging for Haddad than facing Rodrigo Garcia, because Garcia voters tend to choose Haddad in the second round, but Tarcísio's voters tend to vote for Garcia over Haddad in the second round. So nothing is clear in São Paulo.
Nothing is clear in São Paulo. I think everyone feels that nothing is clear anywhere until
exactly.
It's over.
We can generalize for anywhere, but yeah. I think in if we look at the numbers and the movement that the voters from one and the other opponents tend to do in the second run, you know, the situation could be extremely favorable for Haddad or extremely difficult to him. But I think once in office, Haddad can make a difference in education, in housing issues, which is extremely problematic in São Paulo. But in education, I think he can focus especially on public higher education and investments in science and technology, which suffered from innumerable cuts and setbacks, both under Geraldo Alckmin's government and during the years of João Dória.
So you've written a lot about politics and about drug prohibition and the need to have a new drug policy in Brazil. Yeah. And recently, one of the main candidates for the governorship of Rio de Janeiro, Marcelo Freixo, declared that after much consideration, he had changed his stance regarding the decriminalization and legalization of cannabis. Freixo now is supporting policies that would prohibit the legalization of cannabis and supporting more police-oriented approaches to dealing with drugs. So what do you see as the – talk a little about your understanding of the issue of the decriminalization of the use of marijuana and the way it's been tied in Brazil to increased incarceration of other groups, especially young, poor Black men. What do you see as the best way forward for Brazil's drug policy?
Well, firstly, what happens in Brazil is that, of course, our history of slavery and our enormous inequalities make Black people in general disproportionately present in the in the prison system and in the criminal justice system, you know, clients of the criminal justice system, let's say. Young Black poor man has been disproportionately targeted by drug law and by police forces because, of course, they are less protected than other actors that are in higher instances of criminal organizations related to drug traffic. They are in the streets, so they are easier to get to be caught by police forces, and then therefore they are more likely to be arrested and to be prosecuted and to be in prison.
And this is very much, I mean, if you're a white middle class person who's consuming marijuana, you will less likely be arrested. And if you're arrested, you'll very likely have your parents get you good lawyers to get you out. Exactly. And if you have a college degree, you're actually not even going to be put in prison, because there's a specific law in Brazil that gives us a favored treatment to people who have a BA degree.
So, there's even some research from the Núcleo de Estudo da Violência at USP, and I have to apologize with the author there. I don't remember her name right now, but she during her research, she got cases in which a young Black man from a poor community was caught with, let's say, 20 grams of marijuana, and he was registered as a drug dealer by the sheriff, while a young white university student boy caught with a high precision scale and a kilo of marijuana ended up as a user. So this is one of the problems that we have in Brazil with drug law. Our drug law has been changed in 2006, saying that users should not be criminally prosecuted, but only drug dealers. But it hasn't established a difference, an objective difference between users and drug dealers. So what happened after the law was changed is that the incarceration rate for drug offense has skyrocketed while it was supposed to decrease, because all the users that were caught were usually, you know, those kind of users that we just mentioned. They are poor, they are Black, they are young, and they were just treated as drug dealers and not as users. More or less one out of four prisoners in Brazil nowadays were condemned by the drug law.
And mostly for minor consumption or minor use.
Exactly. Non-violent, not necessarily related to criminal organizations. Nevertheless, they have the most strict punishment, which is the privation of liberty, the imprisonment, while you have in Brazil already determinations or recommendations by Conselho Nacional de Justiça, which is, how do you explain the
National Judicial Council?
Yeah, that, you know, judges should apply alternatives to imprisonment in those cases, but they just do not.
So you're sounding like you're suggesting that the legalization of marijuana would create an end to kind of serious drug trafficking. It would eliminate the arrest of people who were consuming small quantities of the drug. And that might solve the problem. Is that your proposal?
It's not that it's going to solve the problem, but it's a harm reduction measure, let's say, because you will not send to jail those who are not implied in organized crime. That, you know, we know in the vacuum of the state inside prisons, you know, criminal organizations like the PCC or Primeiro Comando da Capital or the CV, Comando Vermelho, are the ones in charge. So once you're inside, it's very likely then you're gonna get involved somehow, and you're gonna leave prison with a sort of debt in with the organization, and that might get your life just much more complicated than it already is being a former inmate.
Switching back to politics again, I'd like to kind of ask you some more questions about São Paulo, especially the fact that Lula has chosen the former governor of the state of São Paulo, Geraldo Alckmin, to be his vice presidential running mate. What do you think the influence of Alckmin, who comes from the party of Brazilian Social Democracy, the PSDB, which, as you've mentioned, dominated politics in São Paulo for decades, what do you think his influence will be on the Lula administration?
Well, this is hard to tell, but what we know is that what it seems to be happening, actually, is that Lula is making the same movement that he made when he won elections for presidency the first time. And he had as a vice candidate with him, José de Alencar, that was, you know, a businessman from PL, which, you know, today is is Bolsonaro's party, ironically.
The Liberal Party. Liberal Party. Yeah.
The Liberal Party, which today is Bolsonaro's party, but once it was the party of Lula's vice president, with just a picture of, you know, how parties are confusing in Brazil. You know, they change their flags and, you know, things are just hard to follow. And so I think firstly is a gesture of Lula of moderation, as if he has something to prove in that term after being president for 8 years. And Lula has been, I think, after Dilma's betrayal by her vice president, Michel Temer, I think PT is a little traumatized with, you know, vice presidents, and they are looking for a figure that might contribute somehow, and not only politically, but in terms of public policies as well. And also, as all vice presidents are expected to, in terms of governance, in terms of partnerships and alliances, it seems that in the face of the fear that Lula evokes to some people, I think Alckmin has been considered as a more moderate and thoughtful voice that might, you know, help the government in situations of crisis or conflicts. And Lula has been very vocal about how he intends that his vice president is not going to be a figurative one, which is a expression that Michel Temer has used when he first came out as an opponent of his of Dilma, to which he was supposed to be loyal to. So I think there's a bit of, you said a marriage of convenience. I think it is, of course, a marriage of convenience. Alckmin has been suffered many defeats, both in the ballots and inside his party, after, you know, he has promoted João Dória for a while and has been betrayed by him inside the party, and which eventually led to his change from PSDB, you know, he being a traditional and original figure of the party, to
the Brazilian Socialist Party.
Yes, to the PS. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, for our listeners, there are 32 legal political parties in Brazil, 28 of which are in Congress, and no one can tell you the names of all 28. It's impossible.
Yeah, it's hard.
It really is. Another really fascinating figure in Brazilian politics who has become a central figure in the election cycle is the Supreme Court Justice and Presiding Justice of the Supreme Electoral Court, Alexandre de Moraes, who is from the state of São Paulo. He was nominated by Alckmin to be the Secretary of Justice. And then he, in 2017, he was nominated by Michel Temer to the Supreme Court. So he was someone supported by the person who stabbed Dilma Rousseff in the back. Nevertheless, he has been pretty strong. His defense of the Supreme Court and defense of democracy as a person overseeing the elections. What do you think has been the effect of Moraes in this whole process?
Well, Alexandre de Moraes, he was a CEO for FEBEM, which today is Fundação Casa, responsible for measures restricting the freedom of young people in conflict with the law. He was Secretary of Justice and Public Security in Geraldo Alckmin's government in São Paulo and Minister of Justice and Public Security in Michel Temer's presidency before being named for the Supreme Court. Well, I think he has been very celebrated by progressive forces and sectors in the face of attacks by the current president and his supporters on Brazil's democratic institutions. he's being seen as a hero by some people as well, you know, in progressive sectors, because he has somehow contained Bolsonarism in their attacks to fundamental rights and to democratic institutions. Nevertheless, Alexandre de Moraes is not a progressive himself in, you know, his former positions in his political career, because that's something that we have to remember. Alexandre de Moraes is a political player, and he has been for a lot of time. He is a former public prosecutor, and in this sense, he is a model of a public prosecutor, as we have in Brazil. You know, he's a punitivist and somehow authoritarian as well. Although he has been playing this role in containing Bolsonarism by one side, he has shown himself in other decisions or actions that he made in the Supreme Court that reminds us that, you know, he is not a person of a defender of freedom and progressive agendas. He, from a substantive point of view, Alexandre de Moraes, it's very far from being this protector of freedom. The lawsuit that called for decriminalization of cannabis has been sitting in his drawer for years. That's one thing. And when he was a minister of justice and public security, he has been seen in a very controversial video tearing cannabis plants from the ground in one federal police operation for dismantling a plantation of cannabis farm. This is one example. The other is that, you know, recently Gilmar Mendes has sued the journalist Rubens Valente for citing him on a journalistic investigation, and ordered him to pay a disproportionate compensation to the minister. And Alexandre de Moraes has supported such decision. I mean, we have to remember that he is a political player and a center linked to center-right sectors, and he's also a hardline jurist. So Alexandre de Moraes has become a kind of a hero in a context of the immense irregularities and extravagances in the fake news inquiry, in which he is a victim. He is also the responsible for the inquiry, and he votes for the inquiry all at once, which makes room for contestation. And so maybe he's not very cautious with the instruments he has been using as a minister, and that could foster a backlash somehow.
Right. Also, his decision to basically seize information of eight business people who were supporting Bolsonaro, which on one hand seems to be a very important thing, because in the last election there was millions of dollars spent illegally by people promoting the fake news. On the other hand, you know, is this an overreach by the judiciary? And this is the exactly. question. I think many of us saw the overreach of Sergio Moro when he condemned Lula to prison. And so there's a concern that the judiciary might be in the name of defending democracy actually undermining it. So can you explain a little bit about how you understand Freixo's policies, his turnabout policies, and what we can expect from him and also the Lula presidency regarding drug policy?
Of course. In the case Lula win the election, what we could expect in terms of his drug policy is that he has already spoken about changes in the drug law, which is very positive. He seems to be well informed about the damage that the law has done by deferring users from dealers, and should be informed, I hope, about those countries' experiences with the issue, almost all of them in the Americas, Uruguay, the United States, and Canada. Freixo has, just for those who are not familiar with, Marcelo Freixo is a historical advocate for human rights and drug policy reform in Brazil. And he's renowned for it. And as a candidate for Rio de Janeiro's government, he has recently not only avoided the issue, but when questioned, when asked about the legalization of cannabis, he said that the debate has divided society and that it was not the appropriate moment to discuss it. And this has disappointed many, many of his historical colleagues in the field of drug policy reform. I think this is a topic that has hardly ever been discussed publicly and institutionally in Brazil, a country that has almost one each four prisoners incarcerated for drug law offenses. So to inaugurate this public debate in the context of a very polarized and violent election, it's not something easy for sure, and certainly seems that it's not something that he's with, it's not a risk that he's willing to take that might threaten his chances to win the state of Rio de Janeiro's government.
It sounds very similar to the way in which Dilma Rousseff backtracked on the question of abortion rights in order not to alienate evangelical Christians and other supporters, which meant that, again, a very important debate was postponed about women's right their reproductive rights, the rights over their bodies.
Nevertheless, I think, of course, many advocates for abortion were very disappointed with Dilma to have a woman in a presidency and not any change in regards a health problem in Brazil. Maybe progressive politicians have learned something with this case and might do different once in office, because everybody knows that Marcelo Freixo is very aware of the damages that the drug laws have been playing in Brazil, as he is of the deaths that has been caused in poor communities, even among children, in the name of the war on drugs. So I think even those who are disappointed with him now expect that once in office, he will at least debate such themes and to form opinion that is aligned with what the best experiences, international experiences, have been showing for us.
So, Fernanda, what do you see as the main issue in the election?
I think the key issue in this upcoming election is inevitably the maintenance of the democratic regime. It is not only through the holding of the elections, which it seems will indeed take place, but above all, through the recognition of the legitimacy of its legitimacy by society. This may seem obvious, but the electoral system has been under attack for so long that we may fear that it is not recognized by parts of society, as we have seen in the U.S., where there are polls indicating 40% of the U.S. do not believe Biden legitimately won the elections, and confidence in elections have been fading since January 6th. So, and obviously the obstacles to the eventual new government will face are also enormous and challenging, and will be exploited by the extreme, by Bolsonarism, to try to delegitimize it and tumult the political environment.
To close up today, are you optimistic about 2023?
No, I'm not. Unfortunately, I think that firstly, once election is won by Democratic candidate and the election results are respected, we'll still have a huge path to come back to where we were 4 years ago when, Bolsonaro was elected. So, of course, I'm more optimistic to see the chances of Democratic candidates to win, but I am not optimistic about the size of the challenges this person will face in the future.
Well, on that optimistically pessimistic note, I feel the same. I think the challenges that the Washington Brazil office has, that progressive forces in Brazil have, are immense, because the economy, the society has been badly damaged. And I see this in the United States as well, recovering from the damages of Trump, and the fact that both Bolsonaro and Trump are going to be ongoing factors in this politics, which is not at all encouraging. Fernanda, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule as an amazing journalist to join us on Brazil Unfiltered today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, James. Thank you for everyone who have been listening to us. I hope I have contributed.
I hope that you've enjoyed the interview. If you are watching on YouTube, don't forget to like the video. And if you have not yet subscribed, please do so. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. It helps if other people find the program. Have a great week. Until next time, até a próxima.